You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates, I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Now, 3/4 of all greenhouse gas emissions are anthropogenic. They come from us and from what we do, and our food plays a huge role in that. So today we're asking, how should we change our diet to lower those emissions? A decade ago now, there was a balanced diet modelled by computers at Aberdeen University, which promised to cut the carbon footprint of your diet by 90%. It comprised pasta, peas, fried onions, brassicas, sesame seeds, dry whole grain breakfast cereal, and sweets. I'm not sure I could manage a week on that, let alone a lifetime, but how should we be eating? If we can't trust the computers, could a new approach, the climatarian diet, be the solution? If you're happy to ditch avocados and mango but keep on eating meat, stay listening because it might just be the one for you. Joining me to sample this diet and ask how it might reshape the food industry is the brilliant James Hand, co-founder at Geeky Zero, a social enterprise which aims to help people live sustainably. Hello there, James.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, obviously, this is a huge topic, but let's just sort of start off by stepping back and looking at the scale of the problems, hopefully with some numbers first. I mentioned that 3/4 of all greenhouse gas emissions are anthropogenic. How much does food contribute to that total?
Food's a big part of that. So for most people, food is about 25% of their carbon footprint. So a big chunk. And there's sort of two big components to that. One is what they actually eat. That's most of it. The other part is what they throw away. And those two things generate that sort of total of 25% of everyone's personal carbon footprint.
And in terms of sustainability, there are lots of different issues, aren't there? There's not just the emissions, there's other issues, soil degradation, other things like that. What sort of springs to mind as being the most important of those to you?
Really, the one that is key for climate change is carbon. So that's the top. But you're absolutely right. Other things like land use, water use, biodiversity, they're all absolutely crucial as well. So it's a topic that covers a lot of different areas that affect the environment.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about this area is that you have to juggle different issues, don't you? Because you could talk about land use on one hand, but possibly that will increase your water use if you go for a different system. So you have to sit back and have a very thoughtful perspective on it. Now, the global food system is phenomenally complicated, world's biggest enterprise. From an individual perspective, it's very difficult to grasp your own impact. So what kind of difference is possible, would you say, by changing what we eat?
On a personal level, it's really big. The average carbon footprint of somebody in the UK is around 9 tonnes. And in order to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, that needs to be 2.5 tonnes by 2030. We've all got to make really significant changes in the way that we live our lives. Mm. Now, food is around 2.5 tonnes. For the average diet in the UK, for the typical diet, but you can cut that in half with a more sustainable diet. So you can have a really big impact on that sort of trajectory everyone needs to get to. Mm. But as well as what you do individually, you also have a big impact in terms of the influence you have when you make those changes to people around you or the way that you're spending your money. So yeah, you can do a lot yourself and you can do a lot to encourage other people to change as well.
This is not a new concept. Every year we have Veganuary, and people are beginning to become aware of the impact that they can make. But if we just cross meat and dairy off the menu, would you say that we're most of the way there? Is that as much as we really need to do?
Yeah, I mean, if you stop all meat and dairy, you will make most of those big cuts. So it makes a huge difference. You know, you're left with maybe some fish and some eggs for animals and animal products, but that's pretty much it. You'll also make a particularly big difference to methane, you know, one of the most potent greenhouse gases, by taking out the meat. So another big bonus there.
Yeah.
However, I mean, I started measuring my carbon footprint 10 years ago in 2011, started Geeky in 2017. I've met a tiny number of people who've made that big change from typical diet to being fully plant-based. So whilst it would really work, it's not going to work for most people. And I think that's why we have to give them much better options about the changes they can make gradually, rather than sort of this big stop and go, right, as of January, we're now all going to be 100% plant-based.
And can you go a little bit deeper into the impact that different foods have on the planet? What are the headlines for you and some of the sort of quirky, more interesting aspects?
Yeah, I mean, the ones that are very well known now around red meat. So red meat has a high intensity, both because of the methane and also the land use and the crops that you need to feed the animals. It's just not a very efficient way to grow protein. Mm. Some of the ones that surprise people a bit more are things like pet food.
Yeah.
So if you've got a big dog that eats red meat, that might well have its own carbon footprint of around a ton. So that's one to think about. And there's been some great innovations around things like insect pet food that could really reduce that.
Absolutely, yeah. It's an exciting area, that, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah. Other areas that sometimes surprise people are prawns. So farmed prawns also have quite a big carbon footprint, especially if they're coming from areas of the coastline that were previously things like mangrove swamps, which are really great for storing carbon. And the last one that isn't great for some people because it's so enjoyable is cheese. So because cheese takes so much milk to make, it has a high carbon footprint. All that said, the ones that people are the most familiar with, red meat and then white meat, those are definitely the biggest contributors in terms of the most normal diets that people eat every day.
Mm, what about if we just move to eating kangaroo, which doesn't produce methane?
Well, definitely the sort of the meat that's non-ruminant, like chicken, pork, and kangaroo, that would definitely help, but it still has a higher carbon footprint than sort of fruit and veg.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the issue, isn't it? You cut off one aspect of it, and we're all chowing down on kangaroos, and suddenly other things become more important all over again. So let's move on to this idea of the climatarian diet. Now, can you put a little bit of flesh on the bones? What does it mean? What's the impact of it? What's the potential?
So when people talk about a climatarian diet, usually they're talking about it very much through a carbon lens. So thinking less about those other environmental impacts or plastic and thinking about how can I reduce my carbon footprint. Mm. And then when people are thinking about something from a carbon footprint, it's about how much carbon for a kilogram of food I'm getting on my plate is being generated in terms of kilogram of carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah.
And that's where it starts to get complicated for people, because it is very unusual to find that figure on a packet of food. There are some companies that do it, and kudos to them. But really, it's about thinking all the way from, you know, the farm practices, whether it's fertilizer use, manure management, through to transport and how food is stored, through to food processing, through to the retail, and then obviously onto your plate. So a lot to think about in terms of what is the carbon footprint of that food that I'm eating.
Mm. And there are, again, we come along to overlapping issues, don't we? So you solve one problem, potentially you cause another. That's not always the case, though. But there are issues such as culture, farming, employment, all of these things. So it's such a tricky area to dive into. Do you find it difficult talking to people about the concept of climatarianism? And do people sort of come back at you with a range of different arguments and say, to basically just try and say, no, please, I just don't want to change anything. I'm good. I'm fine.
Yes. I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, we human beings, we are naturally averse to change. We kind of anchor and don't want to sort of often do things differently. And as a result, you will have standard discussions about the reasons why it's not the right thing to do. So taking red meat as an example and the ways that you can have red meat that does have a lower carbon footprint. And that's also true. And so we need to kind of remember that. The type of red meat that you might get in the UK that, for example, is pasture fed and potentially organic will have or is likely to have a much lower carbon footprint than to take an extreme view, beef from the Amazon, where the soy has also come from land use change in the Amazon.
Yeah.
So it is a difficult topic. However, at the moment, there is more and more people thinking, what can I do to reduce what can I do to buy better, as opposed to needing to make these sort of dramatic statements. So less changing out, swapping, substituting. We're finding many more people are talking about that. And that literally is happening at the moment, month by month. Like the pace of change, because people are now seeing the effects of climate change in their day-to-day lives, in the news, and that's really making them see the sort of the necessity of making these changes in their what they eat and how they live their lives more broadly.
And what's the most important part of this new awareness of sort of reduce, reuse, recycle? Is it COVID-19 that has made us all a little bit more navel gazing, or a little bit more, preferably a little bit more caring, or is it the potential cost of rising costs of things that have a CO2 equivalent emission sort of tag attached to them?
Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons why the pace of change is so rapid is because it's a lot of those factors coming together at one point in time, with no single one necessarily being the biggest. So yes, COVID does seem to have made people think more about their local community, doing things on their doorstep, the news and feeling it in their day-to-day lives. In this country, extreme wet followed by extreme dry. It's sort of seeing it right up front. And then, of course, there are big things going at the sort of the policy level, the government level, like COP26 last year, which keeps it up the agenda.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like there's been one thing. It feels like there's been a lot of things that have been accelerating now. You know, this has been a kind of a known issue for 20, 30 years. But just in the last couple of years, a real sort of coming together of factors that have made a lot of people think, yeah, I'm willing now to make some fairly significant changes.
It feels like a moment in time, doesn't it? And is that also partly because of a difference in the way that shops are laid out? So, for instance, suddenly we have meat-free analogues right next to the burgers in supermarkets, and that's a fundamental change. That it's no longer been, pushed into a strange dusty corner of the supermarket. That there, and to me, that doesn't say that the supermarkets are more loving or more caring. It means they can make money from this. And do you think that's one of the crucial factors, that suddenly it is possible to make a profit from this, and therefore the industry will begin to shift fundamentally?
Yes, and actually we've seen that across not just food but a lot of the industries that we look at in terms of how they're changing, that the commercial imperative is now there very strongly.
Mm.
So you do get sort of different groups of people that care about doing something about climate change. There's this sort of, there is a group that's just sort of like, I don't have the time to think about it. Then there's the group like this one, which is there's now a financial incentive, and a lot of companies are seeing that. And that's really good, because that will help drive a lot of change. And then there's the kind of group that's been around for a while, which is I'm just going to do it because it's just the right thing to do. Now you've got lots of those different groups coming together. But you make some really important points there about the fact that it's no longer strange to walk into a supermarket and get sent round to the dusty back to find your granola while you're wearing your sandals. It is now front and center for people to do. And you're offering people a equivalent or better alternative. And anybody that's tried a plant burger in the last 6 months, comparing that to kind of a lentil burger from even 5 years ago, will have seen that in spades. The pace of innovation and the quality is dramatically different.
In addition, have the arguments changed? Have the issues that are most at the forefront changed? Because concepts like food miles have been sort of taken apart a little bit. Obviously, flying beans from Kenya is a massive food mile, but shipping lamb from New Zealand, where they can produce it better and cheaper and with less of a environmental impact than we can in sheds in the UK, that's actually quite valid. So have you found that the old arguments, food miles used to be such an easy concept. You'd say, well, it's come a long way, that must be bad. But it's more nuanced than that, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's been one of the really good things, the way the academic community has moved things forward over the last sort of 5 or 10 years. So how far something travels will naturally have an impact on its overall carbon footprint. But it tends to be well under 10% of the overall total. As you highlight, though, that can be very different with things like flying. Flying will propel the carbon footprint of a product. So things like buying seasonally, buying locally, that's going to help make sure you avoid those small numbers. Mm. But there's not a great deal of food now that does get flown in by plane. And if you're careful in the supermarket, you can pretty much kind of avoid it all. But you're right, it's now moved to a more sort of complete view of the carbon impacts, the environmental impacts. And I think that's really good because it allows people to make much better decisions than flown or come from far away, good or bad.
Yeah.
It depends.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out another one featuring Dr. Giles Yeo and Dr. Hazel Wallace. We had a fascinating conversation about diet. You can find the episode by going to foodmatterslive.com and searching plant-based foods within healthy, sustainable diets. Now, back to the chat. So let's be specific about this, and if you can sort of give us some labels on the classic changes that we could make and the classic mistakes that we make. I do love meat and cheese. I'm much better these days, and I eat a lot less, and I eat better. Eat lots of fruit and veg. I love English apples, but also I eat olives. We've got lemons in the fridge. Olives. We got wine. How would you advise me to start making some tangible changes?
So I think there will be some sort of rules of thumb you can follow, like buying things in season. That's likely to have a lower carbon footprint than buying them out of season. You mentioned English apples there being a great example. I have to say it's a bit of a bugbear when I go into a supermarket in English apple season and find they've come from the other side of the world.
Yeah. Yes, even with knowing that food miles are more complex than we thought, it sticks in the craw, doesn't it?
Exactly. I still know they're ready in Kent,
yeah.
So I should be able to get them.
Yeah.
So definitely that will help. Generally, the balance of the diet, so more grains, especially whole grains, more fruit, more veg, and not necessarily no meat, but just less meat and high quality meat. Shifting the diet in kind of those areas, all of those things will definitely help. Mm. And of course, it will be a healthier diet as well. So that's one of the great things about a sustainable diet. It does confer other really important benefits, especially around health. So with those sort of simple rules, it will allow you to kind of make some quick decisions to kind of get moot shifting towards a sort of a more climate friendly diet.
Yeah. So what should we be buying in the supermarket? I know you've said fresh, local, seasonal, which I think has become quite a mantra amongst chefs, almost to the extent that people don't hear it anymore, which is a bad thing. But just paint a picture of your the ideal fridge right now. So we're recording this on the 9th of February. It's the cold months when there's not a heck of a lot around. It's going to start coming through. But what should be in my fridge right now in order to do my bit for the climate?
So at the moment, you're probably going to have a fridge that's relatively heavy on root veg. So that's definitely a big part of the year. So lots of parsnips, lots of carrots, lots of potatoes.
I love a beet.
Exactly. So ready for roasting or sort of nice sort of Middle Eastern cuisine, that sort of thing. Mm. In your cupboard, you're still going to have your good stack of whole grains and things like that. And in your fruit bowl, you're going to have plenty of apples and pears. So that's definitely that sort of the winter fare of good stews is the kind of stuff that's right at the moment.
Yeah, hefty but good.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. This isn't necessarily how the food industry works, does it? The food industry works by making a profit, as much of a profit as it can, keeping that up for as long as possible, preferably not killing people along the way. We have a complex and complicated supply chain. Presumably, this idea doesn't necessarily sit well with the food industry unless they can make money from it. How do you suggest they do that?
So you're absolutely right. It's got to work. In order for the change to accelerate, it has to work commercially. And at the moment, I think one of the positives about a lot of the new products that are coming out is they are quite high margin products for the supermarkets. A lot of these new sort of, from burgers to plant-based burgers to oat milks.
Yeah.
I think the challenge is going to come as we try and ensure that all of those products are available to most people. So that's when, how do we then sort of get the prices down, and then the margins might not be as attractive, they might not be as good as the products that they're used to selling, but that will be really crucial. So how is it possible that a pint of oat milk costs more than a pint of dairy milk? Mm. It says that something's wrong in that equation. Both sides of it, some of it that the dairy farmer is simply not being paid enough for that milk, especially when we take into account the environmental externalities. And on the other side, that the oat milk is probably at the moment being priced knowing that it is appealing to a higher income bracket. So right now, it probably is quite a favourable act for the supermarkets. But to go mainstream, I think it's probably going to get a little bit more challenging. But it has to, because these diets need to be available at a good price point for everybody.
And what are the other ways to convince people? I mean, we've talked a little bit on this podcast about the concept of climate impact labelling. I think you mentioned sort of ideas along that that kind of route earlier on. Is that feasible, do you think? Again, complex, I would imagine.
Complex for the company, but not necessarily for the consumer if the labelling is done well. Mm. And I think there are probably quite a lot of lessons from front-of-pack labelling that we can learn if we fall for climate labelling. So making sure that it's compulsory, that's a big first step. Because if it's not, how does somebody compare two things on a shelf if one does and one doesn't? Making sure it's consistent, so shown in the same way, with the same colours, you know, that type of thing. And also, even compared to front-of-pack labelling, making it as simple as possible. People like, you know, one clear metric that they can use to kind of judge it. And then they can go, you know what, this one is a higher carbon product, but at the same time, that's okay, because when I look at my basket, it's actually stacked with lots of things that offset that. And then they can make sort of the whole decision rather than kind of piecemeal and trying to second guess either by, you know, looking at the marketing or sort of judging things that they might have heard about certain ingredients and those sorts of things.
Is it likely to become mandatory, do you think?
As an optimist, I hope so, because more and more people are talking about it. There are more and more small companies working on it. There are some charities working on it too.
What do they look like? I've not yet seen a climate impact label. Have you seen any? And if so, what do they look like?
So most of the ones I've seen so far tend to follow in some way the front of pack labelling, with some sort of scale, with some sort of colour gradation. I've seen some that go for almost like the back of pack label, looking to kind of cover lots of different areas. That feels too much for a lot of people, I think, at the moment. And of course, many of the supermarkets are also following their own initiatives to do it too. I haven't sort of dug into those ones yet, but it feels like, yeah, there's going to be lots of coming in. And that's a bit of a danger at the moment, that if certain supermarkets use certain ways, certain sort of third parties do it, then it gets just more confusing for the consumer. And that's exactly what we don't need.
Although on the positive side, I mean, traffic light labelling for foods started off as a fragmented idea that everyone was doing it. They were all doing their different versions of it. And so regulation stepped in because they realised that people were already doing this. Now let's make it conform. And so possibly the same approach could happen for climate impact labelling, that everyone's doing it. That finally the food standards or somebody will have to come and step in and go, oh, okay, all right, guys, all right, let's standardise this.
Absolutely. And a really good example of where regulation can help. Bringing all those ideas together, bringing all the stakeholders to the table and getting something that's consistent and simple for the people that really matter, which is the people buying their food.
OK, now, I mean, I presume that this is a question that's been asked you a fair few times. Are you just taking the fun out of food, or the joy or the celebration out of food by making it an environmental concern?
I think that is absolutely what can't happen. And I think that's probably something that the sustainability movement did, not just for food, but for climate change more broadly, almost trying to historically like scare people into the idea it's so bad, you've got to do something. Mm-hmm. And that's not how people work. It's not how you get the best out of people. So we have to, as we were saying earlier with the innovation, that the choices on offer to people have to be better choices, or at least equivalent choices. And also we have to find a way to help people see that this isn't and can't be about banning stuff.
Yeah.
It's about balance. It's about changing the quality of what you eat, not sort of these whole scales, you must do this, you mustn't do that. I can't see a situation where that can be sort of successfully like rolled out to people, because it's working against their own personal value system. That's not going to be a battle, or indeed an area that anyone's going to win on.
I'd say it's similar to trying to get kids to eat better. You can't say that what they love is bad or in negative, because they know it's not. They know it's great. They know that chocolate tastes fab. They know that a burger has got the salt and fat and sugar that they want. What you've got to do is try and make the other stuff more interesting, and it's an uphill struggle. You know, you do cut out a big old job for yourself.
Yeah.
So take me out on a climatarian night out. Let's go to the pub. Let's go for a meal. Go back and have some junk food. How would it unfold in a climatarian climate?
The good news is that in terms of what you drink, most of that's probably in some way sort of fruit or grain based. So that's going to have quite a low carbon footprint. Mm. Now, having said that, in most things climate related, less is more. So it's a couple of drinks rather than too many more than that. But that's going to be good. What you eat will be a lot of the things we've talked about already, in terms of whether it's the plant based option, whether it's the vegetarian option. But also one of the nice things about a climatarian diet and what we were just discussing in terms of not banning stuff is that it might be that you decide that night is the night when you do enjoy something on the menu.
Yeah.
Because you've thought about it, and so it's not a night out spoiler. When you get home and have the trashy food, similar in terms of the ingredients you might be using, but you might also be thinking a little bit there about the packaging. Plastic comes from fossil fuels, the less of that the better. And then if you're going to sort of flick on Netflix for some sort of TV and while away the rest of the evening like that, that is a fantastically low carbon way to spend time. You can watch a lot of binge TV sets and not do too much damage to your carbon footprint.
And how do you think the food industry has to adapt to cope with this? Because I think it's not a question of if. I think this probably does have to happen. You know, it's one of the areas where we can make a significant change, that there is a will amongst people. So, but the food industry can continue to make profit and make a buck from all this. What do you think is going to happen first?
I think at the moment we're definitely seeing already those trends of more and more climate-friendly products appearing in the supermarket, placed in the same areas that people would expect them to be. So that's a big trend. I would imagine we'll continue to see the broader backlash against, less about carbon directly, but more the concerns around things like plastic and recycling, because it's something very tangible for people to think about. And I hope that's then backed up by some regulation about the balance of products and pricing that we're going to see in the supermarket, and especially around labelling. So it feels that we don't need to predict too much of the future for what needs to happen. It's already happening, and it's sort of accelerating.
So what's your view of the future of this? How soon do you think it's going to be before possibly we get labelling on packaging, or before it becomes the most important part of people's shop?
Things always happen slower than they need to in the climate movement. And something like labelling, if the discussion really is only just getting off the ground, then it's going to be years until we see it. So I do wonder if we see some innovative startups coming up and sort of solving the problem. The challenge for them is getting the data. If they can get sort of more access to data that manufacturers have, I'm sure they could come up with some really exciting ways, for example, to show people's baskets. So it feels at the moment that the labelling probably comes after the big shifts that are already happening in consumer spending, especially among younger generations. So I think it'll be the spending power that might move before the kind of the regulatory power.
Yeah. Yeah, which seems to go for the vegan movement as well, doesn't it? Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so my last question is the sort of the obvious one, really. You know, low hanging fruit. If we want to start our journey down a climatarian diet, what choices are the most impactful and the simplest ones to make?
The big one would be looking at doing something tangible, like looking at the food that you eat over a month, and how much of that is red meat and other types of meat. And planning in the month after that how you can remove some of it, either by substituting, putting a bit of plant-based mince in with your normal mince for a spaghetti bolognese, whether changing completely for some of the recipes that you have, maybe deciding on the day and the month we're actually going out and having a treat on, but actually making a change by trying to make it real, having a checklist, that sort of is a really key thing. Otherwise, you kind of end up slightly in the New Year's resolution camp of, oh, I'm planning to do this, but I don't really have a plan for how I'm going to execute it.
Yeah.
So yeah, scribble it down, tick it off, and then give yourself a sort of a pat on the back if you've achieved it.
Yeah, it's a great start. Well, James Hand from Geeky Zero, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Table Talk podcast. We've got hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Try searching on the site for an episode we recently did called What Will a Plant-Based Diet Look Like Years From Now? Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.